Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with Danny Dorling, a social geographer and the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. Danny was honorary president of the Society of Cartographers from 2007 to 2017.
Danny is the author of dozens of books, including Slow Down, The End of the Great Acceleration, and Why It's Good for the Planet, the Economy, and Our Lives, and Fintopia, What We Can Learn from the World's Happiest Country. His work concerns issues of housing, health, employment, education, and poverty.
Danny is someone who truly understands the impacts of our global slowdown, one that we've been in since the late 1960s, as he points out, and shares Andrew and my sense of rational optimism. We're so excited to speak with him today.
But before we jump into it, we'd first like to thank all of you who've been listening throughout the year and mention that this marks our 100th episode and the final one of 2020. We're going to take a short pause now as we develop what At a Distance is going to look like in 2021.
Again, thank you all for listening, and let's get Danny on the line. Hi, Danny. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Thanks ever so much for having me.
I wanted to begin with, in your new book, Slow Down, you go into the etymology of the word slowdown. And I was wondering if you could talk about this as well as define slowdown more generally and broadly for us.
Yes, it's not a word we've always had. It's a word which really came to the fore in the last couple of hundred years to be used. And slowdown doesn't mean to go backwards. It doesn't mean to fall. Slowdown means to still go forward, but just more slowly. But we're such a kind of acceleration addict species now, that we tend to see slowdown as a bad thing. It's still going forward, you're just not going forward at helter-skelter speed.
Mm. And what has the slowdown, I guess, looked like in the context of this great acceleration as we know it?
The book Slowdown, I didn't mean to write a book called Slowdown. I meant to write a book about what things are speeding up and which things are not speeding up. And 7 years ago now, I started measuring things. I was lucky, I had some time. I was a bit bored. And I started collecting data sets of fairly high quality data about human beings and measured this, the speed of change. Mm. And what I began to notice was that in many things, there had been a period in our recent past, in our parents' or grandparents' or great-grandparents' time, when things really had speeded up. We've had an enormous acceleration. I don't know, the speed of moving around, you know, from sitting on a horse to a car to a plane, that kind of thing. But in our lifetime, you found very few of these. In fact, I only found four major things that were still speeding up. Hmm. Most things were slowing down, and this had not been the case in the recent past. I then worried that I was missing the things that were speeding up, because we always talk about society speeding up. So I then spent a few more years collecting more and more and more data. And eventually I just had to conclude we're in a remarkable era of slowdown. We need to accept things are slowing down. And this is actually something which is quite new.
Mm.
And something which is surprising, because we're not geared to accept it. We live in a society where to go fast is seen as good. My university, every Friday, releases a whole series of press releases about all the amazing discoveries we've made. You know, you have to have discoveries every week. And if that's your background, then accepting that things aren't actually speeding up as much as they were, the discoveries are, some of them are good, but they're not quite, you know, I'm based in Oxford. Okay, we're one of the people who produced a vaccine for the virus, but, you know, it's not that new technology. Producing the first vaccine was, that was quite incredible. Producing a bog standard, fairly, you know, new one, actually, apart from the fact we could do it quicker, there's nothing that surprising about it.
Well, in terms of economic growth, population growth, and innovation, like you were talking about, why is a global slowdown possibly a good thing?
Because when you look at the alternative is fairly awful. If you take GDP, economic growth, the decade of the greatest growth worldwide, but also in the USA and UK, was the 1950s. The 1960s were almost as fast, but not quite as fast. And that's, you know, why we talk about taking your Chevy to the levee and then the amazing changes and getting a car and the new house in America. The 70s were slower than the 60s. And we often at the time blamed it on industrial disputes and the oil shock and so on. But the 80s were slower than the 70s and the 90s were slower than the 80s. And when you just step back, you go, it really was slowing down. And the most recent decade, even before the pandemic, was the slowest ever for worldwide economic growth. Now, because we can't accept slowdown, we keep on coming up with excuses as to why, don't worry, just around the corner is growth. Why is it a good thing? If you were to take 1950s level of economic growth and just pretend that we had those every decade since the 50s, we would have burnt the planet by now. I mean, the amount of extra carbon we would have chucked out, the amount of resources that we would have mined. You know, we'll be having two or three cars per person. We'd have three or four houses each. It kind of sounds great until you think about everybody else's three or four houses and everybody else's cars. And even with the slowdown we've had, it's not quite enough to make things sustainable. But the alternative would have been awful. We're geared to think of it as brilliant, because we're geared to think individually, if I have more, I'll be happy, and not to think of the externalities on other people of you having more. In fact, people who do get an awful amount of stuff don't actually tend to be that happy, which is kind of good news, because it would be annoying if they were.
Right. Well, in Slowdown, you mentioned the 1918 Spanish flu and how annual global CO2 emissions had a 14% drop between 1918 and 1919. What do you expect to see the results from the current pandemic, and what long-term effects do you think we'll see?
Slowdown, the last changes were made to the text around about the 6th of January. So it was written in complete ignorance of this pandemic. I have a thing about pandemics because they are punctuation points in human history. GDP growth did fall by 14% in that year, but then it rose by 16% the year after. Mm-hmm. And this is partly why economists talk about this V-shaped recovery. There's been some incredible ones since, and before. There was an amazing pandemic in 1889 that lasted for 4 years, which does look rather like the fourth coronavirus, but we won't go there, but it was big. Then the various flu pandemics, 1957, 1968, which came back in a wave in 1970-72. The 1957 one, when it hit Britain, and this had a higher death rate for younger people than COVID. COVID's awful for older people. This terrible pandemic in 1957, we just took it for granted to such an extent that the British Medical Journal published a letter saying people should stop talking about it. You know, it's just going to happen. And the Prime Minister of Britain, Harold Macmillan, made his most famous ever statement, not to do with the flu pandemic, but the economy, where he told the people of Britain, you have never had it so good. At the height of the greatest number of deaths. Now, the contrast between that, this is only 1957 and now, shows partly how we did weather pandemics in the past, apart from, you know, the Black Death and huge ones. We just let it happen. This has been utterly different. This is quite amazing, really, to try to work out why. My kind of claim, I would claim this because I've written a book called Slowdown, but my claim, and this is the paperback has a bit on COVID in it, is that the big difference between now and then is that all those previous pandemics hit us at a time of incredible acceleration and change. 1918 was during, you know, it was actually a small war, but it was called the First World War. It was only Europe and the Russian Revolution and so on. You know, those kind of things preoccupied us. The 1950s and 60s flu pandemics, the world was moving too fast. There was things to do. We were landing on the moon. You know, we couldn't stop for a pandemic. But since then, things have slowed down. We were entering a great global recession, November, December last year. We were talking about Chinese economic growth slowing. More cautious. We know a lot more. And we reacted to this one in a very different way. And it's hard to think that that won't have long-term implications. Certainly one of those four things I mentioned that were accelerating, which is the number of flights per year, not just going up, but going up exponentially. I don't think we'll ever get back to exponential growth of flights again, because we've learned how many of those flights were not necessary. Some were, it'd be lovely to fly sometimes, but you know, I was about to fly over to Yale just before the border shut for a meeting. Can you imagine what on earth was I doing flying across the Atlantic to have a meeting, talk to some nice academics, and then be driven back to the airport and fly back again? That was utter madness, the kind of things that we were doing before. So I think we'll see a change. We'll also see a slowdown about international migration. The UK has already lost 1 million people since April, not because of Brexit, but because of COVID. People who could have stayed in the UK, but they have family elsewhere in Europe or the world, and not being able to suddenly get to their family has changed the calculation of whether it's worth being a migrant. And a lot of that has altered around the world. And we are going to have to pay for this somehow. The cost is similar to a war. The amount of money spent is similar to a war. And if you look at the First World War, and particularly the Second World War, how do we pay for those wars? Well, there was only one group of people who had the money, and we stung them. We taxed the very well off, and we made society dramatically more equal. This is partly why you got the growth in the 50s and 60s. The American affluent, who took most of the money in the 30s, took a quarter of all income in America in the 30s, had to pay for the Second World War. Meanwhile, American workers, when they came back because they fought in a war, got pay rises. So we could, if it's like a wartime exit, we could well see an equalization coming from this pandemic, whereas most people talk about it exacerbating inequalities and how the billionaires have done well and everybody else has done badly. That's how it may look immediately. I have a hope that because the poor have no money and there is a cost to be paid, because speculation on things like housing may well reduce when you have fewer movement and fewer immigrants, I think we might see wealth reduce and the gaps between people. But I'm being hopeful on this. It's the first time we dealt with a pandemic really in this way of something that is not as deadly, say, as cholera. And also, of course, we'll be thinking, at least for, say, 20 years, we might forget after then, but we'll be thinking about the next one. And that changes your behavior when, when you are thinking what happens.
Well, I wanted to know, why do you think it is that humans are so quick to forget these various catastrophes and disaster scenarios? What can we do to not forget this one?
We're kind of optimistic creatures, which helps a lot. So when you ask people about their children and their hopes for their children when they're very young, most people say how great their children will do. And, you know, of course, you don't all. And so then it's good we're optimistic. You know, it'd be awful if we were actually even realistic about life. You know, I'll have five relationships, four of them will all end terribly and fix their arguments. You don't want to be realistic. So there's a natural tendency to optimism, which is good for survival. The amazing thing with the pandemic was it was sitting there on the risk registers. You know, it really, of government ones, it was, oh yes, number one, the pandemic, okay, let's slip to the next one. So it was an amazing source of forgetting because it was actually written down. The other thing that we do, well, I said we're optimistic, we are quite good at worrying. So somewhere in Slowdown, I have a reference to, I think it's over 40 ways in which people have thought that the world could end. Some fairly central ones like nuclear annihilation, but some silly ones like killer bees. We're very good at imagining terrible things happening, and that's useful because it helps avert them. And that may, again, be a human trait that we evolved with over a long time, where you need somebody to say, that burning bush is talking to me and telling you all, go walk over there and get away from here. You know, it may be a survival mechanism. So we're good at being optimistic, but we're also good at worrying. If you really want to worry, you can take some of our biggest worries at the moment, say climate change, carbon, or nuclear weapons, and you can think back about how nuclear weapons, you know, even Einstein wasn't imagining them just over 100 years ago. Climate change, a few people claim they saw it coming in the 60s, but really it's at school I was taught about the Ice Age coming. So that's very, climate change and warming is very new. What that means, if you want to worry, is there will be at least a couple of things happening now which are potentially disastrous, which nobody on the planet has any idea about. but let's wait until somebody comes up with those before we worry about them.
The unknown unknowns.
Yes.
In The Guardian, just a few days ago, you write about some of the drivers of COVID data, which was a fascinating piece. And you write, it's social, not medical science that tells us about the disparate spreads of this pandemic. And not enough people are talking about that. We're flooded with data right now that we don't necessarily understand how to read. Mm-hmm. And part of what you're doing is helping us understand how to look at data. So what are you seeing in that particular case? I think it had to do with Northern England.
Yes.
About the data and the drivers of this COVID spread.
Well, England's bad at very many things, but the one thing we're ridiculously good at is data, an absolute obsession with data. So we have probably the best mortality data records in the world. You know, so within days, we were getting numbers every week about who was dying from this disease. And we have two surveys of who has it. One is the survey based on who's going for tests and who's testing positive. But the other one is a completely random survey, which has been running since the summer, where people are swabbed and we can find out what the actual rate of disease is in an area. Now, what we discover is that in poorer parts of the north of England, which is the poorer part of Britain, more people actually have the disease than are coming forward to be tested. In the south, you know, where I live in Oxford, and people doing a job like mine, I'm a university lecturer, I can do it from home, it's boring, but I can do it. People get tested quite regularly if they feel they've got the symptoms. And Britain, we have a huge inequality in Britain, one of the biggest levels of difference between rich and poor in Europe. Poor people can't really afford to go for a test, because if you're working and you don't work, about a third of the population can't even save $10 a month. People don't have holidays. You can have a very strange idea of Britain. Well-off people, but very poor people. If you, say, are doing the childcare for your granddaughter so that your daughter can go to work and you feel a bit of a temperature, if you're a poorer person, you might, well, again, not go for the test. If you're well-off, then you will. If you live in a small flat and you have three or four children, going for the test and testing positive means that suddenly your children can't go to school anymore and you're all stuck together in that flat for 2 weeks, and you can't work and you might not have a computer. And those were the patterns we're beginning to see. So, of course, it's medical and it's a disease, but people's propensity to act in the ways that they are desire changes. Across Europe, we see this in that Scandinavian countries, Norway and Finland, have an unbelievably low rates of disease. And that's partly because they have a social insurance system that just means you're absolutely fine if you can't go to work.
Mm.
And also, of course, a better distribution of housing and other things are worked out. Mm. Whereas at the other extreme, the UK being one of the more unequal countries, we probably have more people just thinking, oh, that isn't a temperature. That's all you have to do. You think, oh, I've always had this cough.
Right.
And you're not just asymptomatic or symptomatic. There's a very big gray area between the two.
Yeah.
The other thing that we're seeing, good news in the last few weeks in Britain, the infection rate amongst over 70s has been dropping. Mm. So over 70s have been isolating, working out to isolate more. Even poorer people have been trying to not be near their relatives over 70. And, you know, I'll be rash and make a prediction, but given the numbers over the last 3 weeks, we do expect to see a fall in deaths in the next few weeks due to the isolation of the elderly.
Mm.
But we'll have to wait and see. The European picture in general is terrible.
Yeah.
The poster child of Europe was Germany. Everybody said, oh, why can't we all behave as well as the Germans? Well, Germany now has more deaths per day than the UK. I've been studying this disease all year because you're starting to work with epidemiologists. We've been learning so much about it. The key thing is it is new. Okay, it's a variant of a coronavirus, but it is new. And when something is new, what you don't know is incredible. The latest thing that's been going around for the last 2 weeks as an idea is questions about why the rates have been so low across all of Southeast Asia, particularly as we enter the winter, particularly in the colder, more northern parts of Southeast Asia, say Mongolia. What on earth is going on whereby we're not seeing an outbreak? The biggest outbreak was Hong Kong in the autumn, and that's just a couple of hundred deaths. Hong Kong's the size of London. London's had thousands. This is, you've got to be very, very careful about these things. But a preprint came out in November saying that there may have been a genetic shift 5,000 to 20,000 years ago in China because of coronaviruses, and people with Southeast Asian ethnic origin may have a lower chance of getting it and transmitting it. Certainly in America, the lowest rate is in Chinese, the data that's come out. Now, why does this matter for the disease? If it's true, and it may not be true, it might simply be really well good behavior and good control. It matters because suddenly turning to parts of Europe and saying, if only you behaved like Taiwan, you'd have been okay, doesn't make any sense. Right. And that's what I mean about learning about the disease. The other thing we should definitely remember is that the big pharmaceutical companies are absolutely able to produce vaccines, not just one, but many, when they really, really want to.
Yeah.
So all those other diseases which they haven't produced a vaccine for in the poorer parts of the world, I think when this is over, we should perhaps have a little word and say, come on, I know you're not going to make any money out of these vaccines, but...
Look how much you just made.
Look what you made. Look how much we love you.
Yeah.
Think how much we'd be even more impressed by you if you, you know, got on with malaria or whatever else.
That's a good strategy. On the topic of data, what is smoothed data? And how is it useful when we're trying to understand change?
Ah, okay. Often there's only one thing I do, which I think is sort of slightly clever in these things. I once produced an algorithm which allowed you to move circles around so they all touch each other perfectly. And this was called a cartogram. I did this in the 1980s. And you now see it endlessly with computer graphics whenever you see.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did that. It was just moving and slowing things down. Never patented it. For the slowdown book, the trick to getting the graphs which look so nice and smooth is not to measure change at the point that you're looking at in time, but to measure it, say, from a day before to a day after, or a year before to a year after, but not trying to measure it at the exact point. And as soon as you do that, otherwise jittery data looks smooth. I don't do any more smoothing than that. But so if you're thinking about yourself and say how fast you're walking, measure it from a minute before to a minute after and how fast you walked over those 2 minutes. And you'll get a far more accurate idea of how fast you're walking than if you try to measure it immediately. Because that smoothing produces your more accurate idea of the speed of change, when we then look at change in the overall level of anything from Wikipedia entries to temperature to human heights to whatever, the graphs become much more interpretable and easier to understand. And it was just chance. I was just playing around. And that's all I did. And it's kind of obvious. And of course, it's there in physics. When you go back in physics, you can't ever measure something at the exact point it's happening.
Well, it relates to the Bezier curve, right? It's the number of points, so many points on the radius.
Yes. I do use Bezier curves as well to draw some of the graphs. But there's a section in the book about cars and the smooth surfaces of cars. It was Renault who developed them. To get men to buy cars, if you could make the cars particularly curvy, men would more likely buy, and as many men buying cars would buy the cars. So the mathematics of these curves and the smoothing curves comes actually from that 1950s acceleration of GDP and that time of innovation.
Amazing.
And so the innovation in maths required was related to the economy. It goes back to Bernoulli and a few other mathematicians, but most of them were 19th or 18th century. A lot of our world, this is what I mean by the great acceleration, a lot of our world and understanding, really, the 18th and 19th century were not that long ago. It's your great-grandparents, great-grandparents. Whereas before then, things changed much more slowly. The vast majority of people in the world lived a life almost identical to their parents, and their children lived a similar life, often involving an oxen or a horse and quite a lot of plowing. Things were the same.
Earlier on in this program, we spoke to Randy Commissar, who's a brilliant investor in the Valley. And, you know, we were talking about innovation, and he said, well, the last great innovation in the Valley was really the World Wide Web. I don't really think there's been one since. Whereas generally we think, oh, it must have been the iPhone, or, you know, it must have been social media.
Yeah.
But that's not real change.
No, I think he's right about the World Wide Web. Just as I was finishing off Slowdown, the big innovation at that Las Vegas fair they have every year.
CES.
Yes, was a phone where the screen bent slightly. That was all, that, you know, I really thought you were running out of things. I mean, I'm skeptical, and I was a computer nerd as a teenager. So I had a Windows system as a teenager. I'm 52 now.
Yeah.
And the web, I was lucky. I went to Newcastle University in England, which was one of the few universities actually on the web at the time. So I got email at 18 and I'm 52.
Wow.
I wrote a, sorry, this is tragic and not very impressive. I wrote a multi-user dungeon, okay, before anybody was doing them. And of course, if I'd gone in hindsight, if I got into computer gaming, I'd be a multi-millionaire. But
you wouldn't be happy, to use your own words.
I may well not be as happy. But, you know, that was a time, the early computing, and when the microcomputer got out in the 70s and the 80s to the hands of teenagers, you know, that was speed and change. And we geekily program in machine code and so on. What you see nowadays is not that kind of acceleration. It's not the same. We hear lots of talk about AI, but I don't think we see the reality. We're shocked by things like Alexa can understand what we're saying. It's pattern recognition. But you try asking Alexa some really complicated questions. I do this. And of course, you get nowhere. And essentially, Alexa essentially just Googles what you're saying and comes back with the most common answer, hoping your question.
Spell check still doesn't work.
No.
I mean,
it doesn't work, especially if you are dyslexic. It's absolutely awful because it comes up with different words.
Yeah.
Correctly spelled words, but not the one you wanted.
I wanted to mention, connected to this idea, you know, this reality of what you actually did go on to do, not making, you know, computer games, but working as a social geographer. How can geography serve as a lens to understand our culture? How does your work actually work?
Geography is a really strange subject. It's a very British subject. So most British universities have a geography department. In the US, it's only 1 in 10 US universities have one. And the reason for that is geography departments were created about 120 years ago to train colonial officers to go out and run an empire. So our shameful history of geography is we needed people who understood how rivers and mountains worked and tribes and where you got iron and tin from and so on, because we were going to send them out to parts of Africa that we decided we owned. Geography then went through incredible doldrums in the 60s and 70s as Britain lost its colonies. And there are geography departments elsewhere in the world, but not as many for obvious reasons, because the empires are smaller. Mm-hmm. One thing geographers did was study mountains and ice. Mm-hmm. And they used to go up and measure how fast these glaciers were coming down, because we knew an ice age was coming. We just wanted to know when's it coming. And after a decade of the glaciers going in the wrong direction, geographers contributed to the IPCC and global change. And in terms of human geography, growing inequality became the main subject. So it's a very, I know the Greeks had it and so on, but the modern day geography and geographical information systems is a very recent and changing subject, because it literally went from how do you conduct war and control colonies to what are we going to do about saving the planet and about the gaps between people. Mm. But geographers really, we're allowed to do anything because this is a great tradition of geography, because it was so different in the recent past. And because so many things we got wrong, not just thinking that the Ice Age was coming, but, you know, until plate tectonics came along, academics will still teach a truth, even when that truth is utterly wrong. And we kind of pretend we didn't.
Yeah, and of course, data is completely transforming this field.
Mm. Oh, data, and from when we got satellites. And again, satellites are not that old, but you can see when the satellite information starts to come in, that changes what you do. And then the human data. It's quite incredible the amount of information that we now have on people. Mm. And how recent that is. So at the beginning of this, I was talking to you about this amazing 1889 pandemic, but we can't go back and look at it easily, because most countries of the world didn't have population records in 1889, 1890, 1891. So we're currently trying to find out, this is what I'm working on this afternoon, you know, did that 1889 pandemic hit China, Japan, and so on? And we don't know, because the records aren't there.
Mm.
Now we just expect to know almost everything instantly.
on the geography front, I wanted to bring up Finland. Mm. Fintopia is another one of your books, and Finland's ranked as the happiest country in the world pretty consistently. It comes in the top three for many other indicators. Why is that?
Well, somebody has to, but not necessarily doing quite as good a job as Finland. So odds on statistically, there's a kind of worry that Finland can't possibly hold this position for much longer. Everything kind of went right for Finland. It was originally extremely poor, one of the poorest parts of Europe. It was a colony inside Europe. It was owned by Sweden, owned by Russia. You basically tried to leave. So there's quite a lot of Finnish people in Canada and the US. There was nothing going for it. Then it ended up on the wrong side of the war, Second World War. Now that actually is a benefit. So it's a benefit long-term to Germany and to Japan. The advantage of being on the wrong side of the war is that your elite are got rid of. When you lose the war, the elite are got rid of. It turns out almost whoever you replace your elite by do a better job than the elite because the elite get lazy and corrupt and, you know, they know each other from school. And, you know, you might vote in one president instead of another and get really excited about the new president. But, you know, they're all the kind of same. Whereas if they were completely disposed, now a similar thing happens to Finland. And then a sense of solidarity. Finns really had to look after each other. Otherwise, the young were going to leave. Russia was sitting there, very, very scary during the Cold War. And Finns began to work out ways of caring for each other. They've had free school meals in Finland since 1947 for everybody. So they don't call it free school meals. I don't know what you call it in the US. I know the rates you have it. You know, 30% of kids in New York City are fed. But in Finland, you just eat food at school that's provided at school, no issue. And things like that were done. Then they had this most amazing transformation of their education system, where in the 60s, they went to the United States to look at progressive education in the United States in the 60s and in other European countries, but particularly the US. And they took the ideas back to Finland and enacted them mm-hmm. and created the world's best schools. And it's a real irony. You can have a private school in Finland, but people won't send their children there because the state schools are so good. Mm. The state schools don't vary between areas. You just have a good local school. And they're also quite laid back. You take your shoes off, you just wear socks in school. There isn't this kind of military discipline. The average Finnish 16 to 18-year-old can speak 6, 7, or 8 languages.
Wow.
They're brilliant at maths. They're actually good at maths. Rather than having a high GPA or saying, I can do calculus, they can actually do mathematics.
They've got good saunas.
They've got saunas. You know, it's a terrible winter. But there's huge variation. So it gets up to 20 degrees in the summer. It's not all utopia. And the luck's happened as well. But the most amazing thing is the politics of Finland. There's currently 5 political parties are in power in coalition. They happen all to be led by women, so the world got excited because 4 of the women are in their 30s. But the thing that most amazes me is that when a politician does the tiniest thing that's even slightly naughty, I don't know, talks to a union official without declaring it or something, they resign. They just resign. And this doesn't happen in Britain at all. And they're ashamed if they're found out for doing the smallest bad behaviour thing. Because they see themselves like other Finnish people and not above them. Mm. It's not perfect, but it's done pretty well. The most dramatic statistic was 2 or 3 years ago where Finland recorded the lowest infant mortality rate the world has ever known. I think less than 100 babies died. It was a 1.5 per thousand.
Wow.
Lowest mortality rate in the history of the species for the most important social statistic. And you get that not just by having a good health service, but by bringing up young people in such a way that they're happy, they don't have a baby by accident, their parents are able to look after. Everything has to work in your right. society. And there's modest is part of the problem. So in countries with great inequality, you know, like where you are, where I am, we shout about how great we are when we're not. In countries which actually do have some of the best records, people tend to be modest and they don't go around going, look at us.
Yeah. Speaking of America, capitalism is, as you write in Slowdown, a transition, not a steady state. Mm. What do you imagine a post-capitalist United States and ultimately a world could look like?
We tend to think of capitalism now as something that there will always be in this state. But it only really worked with population growth for a start, ever-growing mm-hmm. markets, expansion, not worrying about the externalities, not worrying about the pollution. It's not hard to, I think, argue that the capitalism that our parents lived under and grandparents is not that sustainable. I would say we will head more towards situations like that of Finland now, which we see as amazing and impossible. But, you know, all they're doing is just providing food for all the kids at school, not allowing a school to become a sink school, actually thinking about the repercussions of this. They're not the world's most altruistic people. There isn't some special thing. It only requires a little bit of a nudge in average behavior. Finland's still full of guns. So there's an interesting thing. Finland, they have the most guns per head in Europe. So it's about the people. Now, but we need not go that way. We could head towards barbarism. That's entirely possible. We could see societies falling apart. We could have Blade Runner futures.
Or Coetzee's Waiting for the Barbarians.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be mayhem.
It could be mayhem, which is why you need the worrying. And it doesn't just sort itself out by itself. But we do know that the number of people on the planet is slowing down, the number of children is. Young people should hopefully become more precious as we begin to work out there'll be fewer of them. That happened after the Black Death. And also, just to go back on that, we're free men talking, but you know, the biggest change in the last century has been the changing position of women from the point where my grandmother, as a small girl, was practically seen as a kind of lower form of human being, the things she wasn't allowed to do. And the difference in that in 100 years, if you think about that change, although I've said many things that we measure are slowing down, I end the book by saying, but culturally, we may be speeding up and we can speed up. And I end up talking about Japan and the cultural changes in Japan. I'm an optimist, as you can tell. Human beings have never tried to live with this number of us together. It's an experiment that's unplanned. We don't know if we're up to it. We know we're not designed for groups of this size. But the fact that you can see examples around the world of people doing a pretty good job, warfare in general reducing these kind of things, I can produce you a whole list of things to celebrate. Social scientists tend not to. We tend to be like sharks looking for the next terrible problem. And, you know, so hence where the pandemic is fascinating. We tend not to talk about the good developments, but there are quite a lot of very good developments, I think.
I was wondering if you could elaborate on this context of women in Slowdown, you know, the choices that women made, are making, have made, the fact that they have become much more prevalent as leaders in our society, we wouldn't be seeing the Slowdown the same way at all.
No, even from a really basic level. If you ask the average man in the world, such a thing as this, but from surveys, the average man in the world, when asked about children, wants half a child more than the average woman. So when men got their way, we had population explosions. It's a whole mixture of things, actually physically having the child. As life gets better in every other way, that is worse. But also you don't need to have as many children when you're almost certain your children will survive you. The changing position of women in education to be a majority of university graduates worldwide now, it turns out that we were holding women back. And if you look at genetic research about intelligence, which is a really fraught area and horrible, and I don't think it's necessarily about intelligence, but my favorite statistic on it is that the gap in ability between 15-year-old girls and 15-year-old boys, the 15-year-old girls are so far ahead, puberty as well, not helping the boys, is 10 times bigger than the gap of extra ability of a nerd with the genes for being cleverer. 10 times bigger. So women have this incredible advantage, particularly at young age, to do better, to be more studious. And, you know, maybe that's partly why we held women back. Men, you can be more driven and want to show off and so on. And those differences are there. They're not all socially constructed. There's a biology. But, you know, I work in a world where my boss is a woman, her boss is a woman, and the head of my university is a woman. And I wish the Prime Minister wasn't a man, because we're about to leave Europe anyway.
Right.
It's an incredible change. It's only a partway change. I'm sure any women listening will be spitting blood at, you know, three men celebrating. You know, we're only halfway there. But it is the biggest single revolutionary thing, I think, that has occurred when you measure it. We're almost at the point, we've never been at the point, when a majority of the planet's population have been female, ever, because more boys are born than girls. And that's partly because boys are more fragile. But we're now very, very close to this point because women live longer. And that living longer is partly because dying in maternity is now so much more rare, dying actually while giving birth. So any year now, there'll be the point where there'll be more women on the planet than men.
Do you think it's also to do in some level with the way women take care of themselves better and their approach to life might be a little slower, less aggressive than men?
There are some awful statistics on mortality rates. If you look now at, say, 21, 22-year-olds in the USA and the UK, the young men are three times more likely to die in a year than young women. Simple things, not looking when you're crossing the road, getting drunk, getting into a fight. And because of the major threat to women at that age that used to exist, which was childbirth, well, women aren't having children at those ages, but if they do, it is incredibly safe nowadays.
Mm.
It's really interesting to see, as we level the playing fields, as we allow people to be who they want to be, as we reduce restrictions on sexuality and so on, seeing what kind of behavior looks like it might be inert and not is kind of comes out.
Right.
That's interesting. And social science, we've only just started to be able to do this. We started with same-sex couples, which are fascinating, because with same-sex couples, you can monitor decisions like migration decisions and work out, you know, who really is in charge in the household and take out the sex difference because they're same-sex. So, and this is what I mean by cultural differences. So not everything is slowing down. Cultural differences, accepting people. Right now, this year, of course, another leap on understanding about race and prejudice has occurred. That's been occurring for my lifetime. If you look at surveys of people and opinions by age, you can see racism reducing as people get younger. And I think these are the more interesting ones. What I'd love to see in future is us get away from thinking that there are some special, more able people and some people who are less able. And that's kind of as ingrained as a prejudice in our society. Currently actually ingrained as normal. It's seen as okay to talk about some people as smart and stupid, as talking about men as superior used to be, or talking as white people as superior used to be. And it may feel uncomfortable, but of course, again, it's this same thought experiment about the unknown unknowns. You know, there'll be things that your grandparents say that you find crucially embarrassing and, you know, why can't they be more modern? Well, if you have grandchildren or great nephews, there'll be something they're all saying right now, which in 30 years' time they'll say, you wouldn't believe what they said, you know, the prejudice. And they didn't even know they were bigoted. And they'll be saying that about us.
On that note, what is giving you the most hope as we emerge out of the coronavirus, whenever that may be, as we head into 2021?
It is the attitudes of younger people. It is the fact that we have released them from only being educated enough to read and write, and we've let almost a majority go on to university. Now, universities may not be great, but at least it tells you that we think you've got something about you and time to think. And if you like, we've put these young people through a war, not a war as terrible as an actual war, but we've put them into a situation where they, for the short term, don't have a future. There are no jobs. In Britain, we've taken away their freedom of travel. We're burning their planet. We're polluting it. We're doing it mainly for the benefit of older people. And quite a lot of them are quite angry. Now, when that occurred before, and the most obvious analogy is after the Second World War, young people came back with the Second World War in Britain. It wasn't just that, but we'd had a First World War as well. And the generation above them had really screwed up when there was no need for a Second World War. An angry generation of young people can do incredible things that we think of as utterly impossible. And they've done it before. I hope they'll do it again. So I think part of what my job is to say, yes, we really have mucked up. We could have done better. We chose not to. We chose to sacrifice your future for our short-term benefit, and you should take control away from the older generation. Just because we're more numerous for longer, because of the slowdown, because there are less younger people, they've had to wait, but they will be the demographic majority fairly soon. Mm. And that's my optimism. I want to see the young work in solidarity with each other, not try and compete so that they can all get into the 1%. I'm hoping they're clever enough to work out that they can't all get into the 1%, but you can live a very good life if you actually care and collaborate rather than simply compete.
Mm. Danny, thank you so much for your time today. This is a great note to end on.
Great. Lovely talking to you.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.